Continuing our conversation from last week about ethics in the context of emptiness. One of the things that can slip in as we start to feel into the teachings on emptiness, hear the teachings on emptiness, feel into them, is that they point so powerfully toward this quality of insubstantiality or ungrounded, non-essentialness that everything has, that we can fall into what is maybe the near enemy, one of the near enemies of emptiness. And you know, it's similar to the nihilism we were talking about some weeks ago, but in a way it's a particular kind of nihilism that we could call moral relativism. Any kind of relativism is a trap. Moral relativism particularly is where this one can get sticky for us. And it goes a little bit like this, emptiness teaches us to look for how every experience we have is embedded in conditions and contexts and causes and systems. When we see how embedded an experience is in a system, in complex conditions, we can see that there's not a solid abiding, meaning permanent, core or essence to any thing or entity, right? The cup is only a cup for a few moments, cosmically speaking. It was mud and other pigments and elements. Now it's cup and it's behaving like a cup. And, at some point, possibly as soon as the next few moments or, sometime later, it will be shards. And maybe it turns into something else. Maybe it becomes, a bit of planter for the garden or a couple little black pieces in a mosaic, And when you look at a mosaic, you don't think, hey, broken cups, mostly, probably. You probably think about the image the mosaic is. Look at those spirals or those birds or those whatever it is, or look at that mosaic, right? The form that we give a name to of anything is only ever temporary, right? The name says, this is what this thing is doing. It's really not what it's being, but it's what it's doing. It's kind of names an action in this little temporal moment. The mosaic is a mosaic for this moment. And in a little while, it will be something else. It'll be a ruin. It'll be dirt. It will be, stardust again one day, all of the things. We are instructed then to reflect on this being the nature of things, not just for objects external to us, but of course, the things that really generate emotional charge, right? This body, this body that's clearly, palpably, viscerally, going gray, speaking of graying, get the musculature. I can feel it changing. I can feel the shape changing. I can feel the actions that my body's capable of changing. Nothing is staying the same about it. And then there's other things that we get really attached to. And we get really attached to ideas, right? An idea like justice. I think I know what that means. But what that word referred to 20 years ago, as I was coming into movements for justice 30 years ago, coming into, in my 20s, movements for justice, that word was a different thing then. And it means something a little different now. Right? It's evolved. It's gotten hooked into layers of social movements, and when I say the word, not only is it different from how I understood that word 30 years ago, but if we all, said our definition of justice, all of our definitions would be a little bit different. And necessarily, because they're filtered through our experiences, all of our positionality, our social locations, this moment, how we digest this moment. And if you did, if you wrote a dissertation on the changing valence of the word justice, which you could, and go all the way back through all the translations of the languages, back to, the root records that we have for anything like that concept, as far back as we have records, of course, you know what you would find, right? You would find a changing, evolving, not even an idea, but a whole set of ideas, right? A whole ecosystem of ideas weaving together between different cultures. And so, justice for the Greeks, and justice for the Persians, and justice in ancient India, and justice in China, and justice for the Mayans, and justice in, 21st century North America, very different things. How could they not be? And so emptiness recognizes this and says, oh, there's not an essential nature that goes with a specific word or a label or anything that could be said to be permanent. And you can state that in theological terms and say, oh, there's not an eternal soul or essence in things. It's just far more intimate than that. And the place that the Buddhist philosophers who and logicians who really thought through the implications of this, the place that they went with this was recognizing that if anything was static like that, had an eternal, unchanging nature, it would be impossible for it to be liberated. The only way to posit that would be to say that there was an eternal nature of something that never made contact with anything else. If I had an eternal, unchanging personal soul that defined who I was, and you had a different one that was personal, individual, eternal, unchanging. This is kind of the Christian soul I grew up with. If I had one of those and you had a different one of those, could our souls would never get be changed by contact with each other. So we could never learn from each other or grow with each other or be in any kind of intimacy together, because my eternal nature would have to remain unchanged by any experience that I have. And so you have to, whole theologies then have to grow around that idea. If you suggest that there is that thing, you have to build an entire world system of ideas around that to justify how could that be? And the Christians really wrestled with this. Well, if we have an eternal, unchanging soul, how can there be salvation or non-salvation? And so for the Buddhists, they recognized this, and emptiness is a marvelous philosophy in that way, because it actually makes a lot of room for reality to be the way it is, right? It makes a lot of room for the world to display itself as it comes to us in as a kind of scintillating, like, kaleidoscope of shapes and forms and names that never really point to the same thing over time. The implications of this, though, are in a way that everything we think of as solid, myself, yourself, justice, love, the Dharma itself, awareness, God, the earth, goodness, rightness, all turn out to be fragile concepts. Oh, I see something that I want to call good. All right, right? I then I see it in context and under conditions, and it seeming like an unambiguous good starts to get wobbly. It's not that it's not good, but it can't be only good. Right, because that concept itself has tendrils into everything around it. This recognition blows apart any of the fixated ideas that we hold, that we're taught largely, and that we hold. And when emptiness meets up with fixated ideas, it really, you know, it pulls the rug out. You can't really hold on to an idea if you see it in the light of emptiness. And the idea, emptiness itself, right? That's also an idea. Emptiness itself as a concept is empty, right? Emptiness as a characteristic of phenomena is empty, right? It's empty of solidity, empty of permanence. Emptiness is a concept invented by Buddhists. So, you know, at least in this form, we're looking at it here. So it's a, you know, it's a couple millennia old, not terribly ancient, cosmically speaking, at least in our realm. It's empty, right? It arrived through conditions, based in conditions, not free of those conditions. Even if it accurately describes everything, it's still a concept, a word, you know, an experience, a phenomena itself, that phenomena is empty. And so if we let this teaching, this way of viewing things, seeing things through the lens of emptiness, if we let this touch everything in our life, we might land in a state that is very free, very open, very unfixed. And that can be tremendously liberating. This is really, in a way, a definition of liberation in the Mahayana sense. But we could also fall into a near enemy of liberation, which is a kind of nihilism. Right? If emptiness recognizes that everything is conditioned, everything is interconnected, nothing has an essence, that in a certain way also means that nothing has a fixed meaning. That's a way of saying the same thing. If nothing has a stable identity, like if this is only a cup temporarily, then the fact that what this thing means is cup. Or maybe it means any number of things. Maybe to you it means hospitality. Maybe it means, you know, earthiness, right? Whatever this thing means to you or means to me, this was a gift from some friends, it's my favorite mug, it has meaning, right? That meaning is so conditioned, so contextual, that I can't say that this item actually possesses that meaning in a permanent, unchanging way, right? That meaning is a thing that's idiosyncratic to me. And, you know, and at the moment, the friends that gave this to me and us, we're not seeing eye to eye at the moment, as it turns out. And so the meaning of the cup has changed slightly. It's still my favorite cup. But my friends are not my favorite friends in this moment. Sorry, guys. You know, the meaning has slipped, right? Based in conditions, based in things that happened, the meaning has changed. And that always happens. And so that being what emptiness does, we can fall into the trap of then thinking that nothing has meaning. And in a certain way, that's true, right, in a certain sort of cosmic emptiness focused way, through the lens of emptiness, nothing has permanent meaning. I'm going to keep going on permanent because things have meaning. The cup is meaningful, but the meaning is always changing. It's not an essential meaning. And that's fine for the cup, right? But we were using as our prompt oppressive dualities because one of the main ways that cultures teach meaning and teach morals and ethics is to teach in black and white dyads, right? There's there's good behavior and there's sin. There's being healthy and there's being unhealthy, right? There's black folks and white folks, straight folks and gay folks, men and women. And in all of these ways, a fantasy that the world could be so simple that there might be a binary choice between two of these things. That fantasy is put forward as a way to bring order to the world. And fundamentalists and reactionary folks on all sides of the political spectrum will draw on fixated binaries, especially when the territory around them feels unstable. If you need to pull back into your corner, often the corner that one pulls back into is a kind of, binary certainty, usually with a sort of moral weight to it. This is good, that is not, period. One of the things emptiness points to, because it points to the interconnectedness of things and the deeply contextual nature of things, is it destroys binaries just so easily in a way. And in the big culture war conversations that fixate on binaries, often there's, some group of folks who is trying to defend that a certain thing is a clear binary. There's only biological men and biological women, males and females, and there's nothing else. And inevitably, someone with a science degree comes up. These things are so common, they're memes now, right? Comes up and says, "Let me tell you about biology. Actually, there's, long screed about animal behavior or chromosomes or any number of things that has the purpose of proving that the binary is just factually incorrect, that there's lots of stuff that happens in nature that doesn't conform to the binary." And it's, in general, it's just accurate in all of these cases to recognize that in any of these zones where we think there's a that where culture has taught us that there's a binary, there's always exceptions, and often there's a vast spectrum of exceptions, to where the binaries often define kind of, if not the absolute poles, as if there's a stopping point, but they define two points kind of that are opposites of each other in a spectrum. And if you want to make it even less linear than that, two distinct points in a vast web of ways of being or ways of appearing and unfolding. And so the temptation with emptiness, the relativistic temptation, is to then think that because everything is conditioned and empty, any point on the spectrum has the same amount of meaning as any other point. That's still mostly true. The error then becomes that any point along the spectrum is equally wholesome. And so the place where relativism is okay philosophically, if you want to get like cosmic ontological, the nature of being of things, like sure, everything is as divine as everything else. Totally go there. I'm down with that. But the realm of relationship and action is not about being, right? It's about actions and harm and connection. And so it's in the ethical realm that relativism doesn't work. And so this was so central to the unfolding of emptiness in early Mahayana thinking that it becomes, in a way, the name of the sort of the school that crystallized this way of thinking, which is called the Madhyamaka or the middle way school. And the middle way goes something like this. If you take emptiness too far and you forget the realness of relationships and impact, then you fall into nihilism. You think that nothing matters, and that skillful choices don't matter, practice doesn't matter, liberation doesn't matter, caring for others doesn't matter, compassion doesn't matter. There were folks philosophically who took this viewpoint. The Buddha unequivocally trashed them as being totally unskillful. But that's one end of that spectrum. On the other end of the spectrum is a kind of, you know, binary or dualistic fundamentalism that says this is absolutely right and this is absolutely wrong. This is what you should do. Nothing else is true. And the Buddha trashed those folks as well. And so you get, in a sense, a spectrum of that philosophically would be a spectrum between existence and non-existence, right? A thing exists as important, like this thing has a meaning, and that meaning is permanent and eternal and right. And on this end, it's like nothing has a meaning, nothing is anything. And between, so then neither of those poles is skillful. And skillful here, the word is kusala in Pali. Skillful here, the same word gets translated as wholesome. So wholesome and skillful mean the same thing in this system, which should be an indicator for you, right? There's not good and bad or sin and not sin. It's wholesome, meaning skillful, meaning leads to liberation, leads to well-being, supports well-being. And unskillful leads toward further attachment, further constriction, further non-freedom. And so the Middle Way School recognized that relying on emptiness liberates one from fixated views, but it does not, cancel out the realness of relationship. And so our actions have an impact, even if they don't have a permanent eternal meaning. And so then the middle way, the reason it's called the middle way school, is that it aims to find the skillful balanced place, or the skillful fulcrum on that spectrum of existence to non-existence, or meaningfulness to meaninglessness. And that middle way then is going to be the way of practice. That's going to be where we want to cultivate the qualities of the path. And so this approach then to ethics and to the precepts, I think, is really intelligent. It liberates us from fundamentalism of many kinds. And throughout, you know, spiritual communities, you find fundamentalists everywhere, including in, you know, progressive communities, including in Buddhist communities. You know, you find this in folks who, insist on, some of these were examples brought up in our prompt. So, you know, folks who insist that there's one best way to eat, or one best way to shop, or, you know, to spend our money, or to exist within an economy, you know. You find it in folks who insist that there's one wholesome type of intimate relationship and not any other type. You find it in folks who insist that there's one wholesome way to speak and no other way. One wholesome, you know, way to be in our very complicated lives. And any time this kind of fixated view gets put forward, you know, in a way, it's always reactive. In a way, it's defensive. It's saying, you know, the universe is really the world is really complex. I wish things were simpler, more obvious. Therefore, I'm going to hold on to this fixed view. This is what's good, and I'm going to do only that. And everything that's not that is wrong. And, you know, it's comforting to decide what's good and that you know it and that there's no gray areas around that. But it's always going to be diluted. And so ethics from a middle way perspective tells us to, you know, watch out for that certainty, but also watch out for the kind of giving up that happens when we decide that nothing matters or that everything, you know, everything is morally or functionally the same. It's not, right? You know that it's not. Helping people and harming them are different. Helping people and harming them is also not a clear binary. Sometimes, you know, a certain action kind of helps, but it also kind of hurts. And actually, sometimes we don't even know, right? Or it really helps some folks, but doesn't do very well for other folks. There's a lot of that. And so the reason that this is liberating is that if we fall into the everything is meaningless trap, we're going to do actions that cause harm, that karmically are going to be bad for us. It's very difficult to remain in radical emptiness until our defilements and bad habits are profoundly liberated and seen through. It's kind of like like we did in the meditation on open awareness. If you try to remain in open awareness as a meditation, but you don't have any concentration at all, the mind just goes to wherever it wants. It goes to the brightest object in the room, and that's usually a defilement, right? That's going to be something that I crave, something that I'm afraid of, something that I worry about. A big fat ego story. It's hard to remain in open awareness with that, with material that's that charged, that close by, right? You have to have some ground in order to do that, right? Those things are empty, but they hurt. And so the training is don't fall into that, right? But also don't decide that things must be a certain way. And in the middle there's this beautiful released way of practicing in the world where our actions matter, but they're still empty. It really matters what we say and how we show up and that we're accountable and that we are, you know, responsible to others. And at the same time, right, this was the quote from the Diamond Sutra, there's not really others. Fundamentally, you know, there's not really actions in a kind of distinct, discrete sense. And remember this mysterious bit from the Diamond Sutra that says, you know, the Bodhisattva is the one who is not afraid when hearing these teachings. The thing that inspires fear is that end of the spectrum where everything is meaningless. That's terrifying. But it's even more terrifying to recognize that that you can't, that understanding emptiness doesn't absolve us of responsibility for our actions, and that actions still matter and choices matter. And so it's like there's no escape. Part of where emptiness goes is there's no clean escape. Either end of the spectrum is an attempt to escape from dukkha, from suffering, either through imagined certainty or letting it all go into like it just doesn't matter, right? Neither of them is an escape. And so coming back to the center, to the middle way, is, you know, it's endlessly humbling because you can't slip away. And so there's a coming back again and again to, you know, not clinging, but engaging, right? Engage without clinging, engage without clinging. And that, you know, that is a spectrum itself, right? And we oscillate on it. We flow around it, sometimes more letting go, sometimes more discernment and skillful choices. And we play in that whole realm. You know, and then the training of the training that is the path is, you know, is to, in a way, you know, in a way to become more and more graceful in this middle way, more and more graceful, not falling into certainty nor into relativism. So we care for each other. We care for each other without losing perspective on who each other really is and what each other really means. All right, pausing there. Thanks for listening.